Education and Workforce Committee, please turn your cell phone off or on vibrate so we don't have to be interrupted by its rudeness if you're here to listen. And if you want to participate in the hearings today, the sign-up sheets are on the side over there. We're going to get started. We have an informational meeting on abuse reporting. This is a very important topic for this committee and this legislature, so we're going to have some invited testimony on that, and then we're going to have a public hearing on the two bills you see listed on the agenda today. And I do hope to finish up by 5 o'clock today because our meetings have been going over, and I don't want to do that today. It's a long week already. Something's missing here. Oh, we usually have a screen down. That's what's different. Okay, well. All right.
We can lower it if you'd like.
No. That's quite all right. All right. We are going to hear first from Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, who will review model abuse reporting policies that are sent out to schools. So, Mr. Green. And that is before us, colleagues, at your table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Hopefully in front of you, you have a copy of, at the top it says Oregon School Boards Association Selected Sample Policy, code JHFE, and then the attached pages are JHFE-AR. The AR means Administrative Regulation. The policy that you have in front of you is one that we send out to all 198 school districts, 20 ESDs, and the 17 community colleges across the state for them to take a look at in light of child abuse reporting, because as you know, school employees are mandatory reporters of child abuse in the state of Oregon. Although there is not a mandate currently in the law with regard to districts having a policy on this, we highly suggest that districts adopt this policy. I spoke with our Director of Policy and Legal Services and asked, of our 198 school districts, how many have adopted a policy like this? And because those are official actions taken by a board, she can't say whether, in fact, all have. All have this sample policy before them at some time or another, however. It's been sent to all school districts.
Mr. Green?
Yes.
There's no way for you at all to inquire among the 198 districts if they have a policy?
Madam Chair, we could survey our school districts and see what's on their policy books, but policy manuals for school districts, if you've ever looked at a school district policy manual, generally they're about two notebooks, about that thick, dealing with, you know, money matters, election law, child abuse reporting, other mandated policies. From what I gathered, just talking to school districts across the state when this issue has come up, all the school districts that I've spoken to have a policy that deal with child abuse reporting and what goes on in school districts should that take place in a school district and what their employees are required to do with that. I could find out whether all school districts do. I would imagine all do. In the districts that I've talked to, they tend to be the larger school districts across the state. They all have a policy, and they all pretty much say this, which is, school employees are mandatory reporters. You're required to report. If you have a reasonable suspicion of child abuse taking place, you must report that to DHS or your local law enforcement. One of the things you'll note on that first page of that policy, you'll note bracketed language on that last sentence. Staff may receive information and assistance in identification of abuse and neglect. When you see a bracket in our sample policy, that is optional language for a board to either put in or not put in. Policies that I've seen from school districts on that have either left it out, or some of them even go into more in-depth things about what type of training they're going to have. They'll do annual training, some school districts do, but that is optional language that a school district can put in or not put in. And if you take a look at the administrative reg, generally what the policies say is that last paragraph above that bracketed language indicates that the superintendent will implement such regulations. That's what the last two pages are, the administrative regulations that we send out along with our sample policies for superintendents to use, change, alter, what have you. But if you walk through this one, it talks about reporting, who they have to report to if they have a reasonable suspicion, which is as required in law, DHS or their local law enforcement, what the definitions are of abuse and the definition of child in the law, the confidentiality of records as it pertains to those in school districts, and I realize there's a bill to deal with some of those issues, what it means to fail to comply with reporting, and right now my understanding is that in the law that's a violation, which is a lot like a traffic infraction if you fail to report right now. that there's cooperation with any investigator that comes in, whether they're DHS or law enforcement, and that if a person makes a good faith report that they have reasonable suspicion that child abuse has occurred, that they're protected from civil and criminal liability from that, if it's a good faith report. School districts across the state have used this as their sample policy. As I've said, they've changed it. They've added more things to it with regard to training, with regard to identification. But this is the sample policy that we send out. All school districts have received this. From my information from school districts, everyone I've talked to, they have adopted it. But I can't say for 100% certainty, Madam Chair, that all 198 school districts have, in fact, adopted this policy or a policy like this.
Okay. Thank you.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Oh, you're done?
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is some anecdotal stuff that I have heard as a teacher or school personnel may report what they believe is potential abuse, and then they never hear anything further on it. I guess I'm wondering if the direction we should be looking is, for example, if something is reported to DHS, whether it would be appropriate for that school to get a report back saying it's either founded or unfounded sort of thing. So there's a circle here.
Senator Cruz, that actually is addressed in Senate Bill 749.
Madam Chair, I know that. I'm asking his opinion.
Yeah, and...
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you know, at least from the standpoint of the people I represent, the school board, who ultimately may have liability in cases like this, obviously I think they'd like to close that loop to know whether there is actually something that's gone on with that. In the law, as you know, mandatory reporters, as I said, have to either tell DHS or local law enforcement. And if there is basis for the case to go forward, I would assume that an investigator would come and talk to those folks that alleged, you know, made the report that in fact, we're doing an investigation. We need to know your information that you have. One of the things that you'll see in a lot of policies for school districts is that they not only tell local law enforcement, it's in our sample policy, as a mandatory reporter, those are two you've got to tell, but they also need to tell their building level administrator or at least one of their higher ups somewhere in the school district. And to close that loop back with the school district probably wouldn't be a bad idea. But I know Superintendent Naso from the North Clackamas School District and a detective from Clackamas County will be talking to you about those issues in a couple of moments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Green. I think that it's pretty good information that you give me. Hang out. We might call you back.
Thank you.
All right. Ron Naso is next. And Sally Leet. Can you come up, please?
Madam Chair, I have no intention to question how this is working, but we had sort of thought that Jeff Green might join us.
He's on the list. He can come up now if you like to do it that way. That's fine. And I don't care who starts, if you just identify yourself.
Well, I'll
and your
start.
Affiliation.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Ron Naso. I'm the superintendent of the North Clackamas School District. Sally Leet, who is a principal at Oak Grove Elementary School in our district, and Jeff Green, who is a detective with the Clackamas County Police Department. And we thought that coming together might at least give you an opportunity to talk about the process as it currently exists. Certainly, what we're looking at in Senate Bills 749 and very quickly 765, I guess, there are things in this particular document with regard to policy and with regard to notification and closures that I think do, in fact, go on, at least in our school district, as a matter of course under current law. Probably the piece in the proposed language that is a little bit confusing and I would suspect of some concern to us is this matter of investigation. Under current law, we're authorized, mandated, to move these reports to DHS and the Sheriff's Department or the Police Department, depending on the jurisdiction. At that point, the investigation process proceeds through those agencies. And at least as I'm looking at this language, I can't, I'm getting a sense that this language is asking the school district to be the investigator, and I may be misinterpreting what's in this language. If that's the case, however, we would have some significant reservations about that, only because of the, we're not a law enforcement agency, quite frankly. We do want to make sure that any of any accusation or any concern about child abuse, particularly by employees, does in fact get investigated. In our school district, I can say to you that if we get a concern or a charge that we think is has reasonable content to it, we do, in fact, make that report, and we notify the staff member and put that staff member on administrative leave until the investigation is completed.
Okay. Why don't you back up for just a second,
certainly,
Mr. Naso? I just want to be clear. So if a teacher or administrative employee or anyone in the district who is responsible to be a mandatory reporter, just walk us through what they would do. They would contact whom in your district? First of all, do you have policies?
We do.
Okay. And the policy says to do what first?
That the reporter, the mandatory reporter, is to contact DHS. Or the we say DHS. They can, at a later point, tell us. In fact, they're asked to tell us that such a report has been made. But we have made it very clear to our employees that our reading of the law is that the requirement for reporting doesn't rest with the administrator or the supervisor. It rests with the person who believes that this behavior is going on.
Okay, so
that's step one.
Okay, so step one, though, you indicate that they are to contact DHS. The law says they contact DHS or law enforcement. So you have a policy that says DHS.
We generally go to DHS. Yes.
Okay,
and then Jeff can let you know what the next step.
Okay, so the person has made the report to DHS. They're not required to report it to you as to the administration level?
We'll turn it over. That's why we brought a team.
I'll talk about it from the building level.
And state your name, please.
Sally Lee, principal of Oak Grove Elementary.
Okay.
And I should preface it by saying that I don't know of a principal in the state of Oregon that doesn't tell children that their number one job is to make sure they are safe. And we take that very, very seriously. So in our building, as in all buildings that I'm aware of, the mandatory reporter is the person who has firsthand information from somebody of an abuse. A child typically will report to a teacher or a counselor or maybe somebody at recess. In our school district, we have a very specific procedure, which you should have received copies of, that we, for a first-time reporter, typically the counselor or I will walk the reporter through because they're fairly nervous about it. They are required to share their information with the building administrator so that I know that the correct procedure has been followed. And oftentimes I'm the reporter, oftentimes the counselor's the reporter. But we follow this procedure, we document this procedure, and this year we've had more than 30 cases that we personally in our building have called DHS on, and we've followed this procedure in those cases.
Okay, let me ask you this then, because what I heard from the two of you is a little bit different. Mr. Naso said that the mandatory reporter is the reporter, but now you're indicating that you or the counselor are the reporter.
We're frequently children disclose to us first.
Okay.
Whoever the child discloses to first is the first-hand reporter.
Okay.
So that it's not, Susie said, Bobby said, it's not
right.
But But I had a child come in this morning and disclose to me something that had happened to her. So I was the reporter.
Okay.
And I followed it up by sharing my information with our counselor. So we always have two people involved in reports in the building.
If I may, I think the critical piece in that is that there is a feeling sometimes that if I report this to my principal, then the principal will decide whether or not to make a report. And we try to make it clear to our employees that that cannot happen.
Right.
That it is not the job of the principal to make the decision. That initial reporter is the person that is to make it.
Additionally, it's not our call as to whether there is substance with your report. We're not the judge and jury on this. And so when a child comes to us with a concern, and when we say a credible concern, we make sure there's some validity to it. The child hasn't written a story for an essay and just completely imagined it. But we always follow up.
Also would like to clarify, and maybe Sally could clarify, the 31 cases have not been cases of students or parents reporting teacher.
Oh, absolutely.
Being involved, okay. I don't want to.
Nor have they been cases of principal causing trouble. No, it's primarily things that occur in our community, that children, they witness domestic violence, which is a mandatory reportable offense.
Mm-hmm.
Things that goes into, that's most of what we see.
Okay. Senator Morissette, you have a question?
Thank you. Well, when I taught middle school and high school, that was drilled into us from the very first day. You have to report. Mm-hmm. My question will be later on, but if you recognize or suspect something, that you have to either question the student or call someone in to do that. Now, we used to have a school nurse. I don't know if you have school nurses. But it's kind of hard when a teacher is conducting a class to question whether or not the black eye that a child has is the result, what's the result of. So is that a procedure that is recommended? Is that somebody else is called in to hopefully a counselor or a school nurse?
The procedure in that case is, as you say, it's drilled into educators, all educators, the assistants out at the playground, the person selling milk in the morning. If they are indisposed teaching a class and they notice little Bobby has a black eye, they frequently will handle that by sending a note to the office saying, would you be willing to talk to Bobby? I noticed he has a black eye. They will send the child up. We will interview the child, at which point we become the first point of disclosure. And in that case, we would report. But one of the things that has been gone over again and again with staff members is timeliness is of the essence. You don't hold on to a child who has a bruise of some kind until 2:15 on a Friday afternoon. You deal with it as soon as you see it. And that would be a case of the teacher teaching and wanting someone to tell them right away.
Okay. May I follow up, please?
Sure.
And I think you raised a good point of staff persons, because when we talk about staff, you're talking about the cafeteria working, you're talking about the custodian, you're talking about the secretary, who are in a much better position at times to notice these things. So that's part of your procedure?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
A couple questions. What you said earlier about your 31 cases, so you could potentially be reporting potential abuse cases of kids that aren't even in your school. Just something that, I mean, if somebody brings in, you hear something from a student and it may be somebody entirely removed from your school, but you would still be reporting that?
Happens very rarely.
Okay.
But more likely it would be, this happened to my older brother. My older brother goes to another
school. Okay.
In that case, we would call either an administrator or a counselor in the other school, give them the information, so because they're more likely to have a relationship with the child than
right.
someone just coming in. But that's how we would pursue that, and leave it to the person in the building where the child resides.
Okay. Madam Chair, the other question would be, do you generally get feedback from DHS after you've made the report?
No.
Okay.
And in their defense, I would love feedback. And if I call, they will give us feedback, but they are understaffed and overworked also.
Well, we'll have them up here after you talk to us about that. Thank you. Okay. Did you have any more to talk about? We'll turn it over to Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jeffrey Green. I'm a detective with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office in Oregon City, Oregon. I am currently a detective assigned to the child abuse team that we have in the Sheriff's Office, and I've been doing that for 12 years, and I've been involved in law enforcement in the state of Oregon since 1984. Give you a little background about myself so at least you have an idea where I'm talking from. I'm currently a member of the Department of Public Safety's training, the Child Abuse Training Committee, where we help to determine what child abuse training will be provided to law enforcement officers in the state, how we obtain funds through the unitary assessment fees to do so. I'm certified to teach child abuse in the state of Oregon for law enforcement officers. I am a former chair of the Clackamas County Multidisciplinary Team, as well as the former chair of the Child Fatality Review Team for Clackamas County, and currently the vice chair for the Multidisciplinary Team. I'm also a former member of the Children's Justice Act Task Force for the state of Oregon. Thank you for inviting me to come down and speak to you today. I was asked to tell you about what happens when I receive that phone call or that report to come to a school. I'm sure you're well aware that schools are the biggest mandatory reporters we have. They have the most contact with our children in the state of Oregon, besides parents, and sometimes they even question that. When we receive a phone call from a school or we receive a report from DHS, as there's mandatory cross-reporting between DHS and law enforcement on any issues of child abuse, we respond to the school. If it's something that's within the family, we will go with a DHS worker, which is mandated, not only set out by statute, but also by multidisciplinary team protocols. When we go to the school, we make contact first with the school officials, and oftentimes it's with the principal. We want to determine who made the original phone call or who received that first outcry of help from the child. That disclosure that's also important to start this process. I will want to talk to that person. I want to find out how the disclosure came out, what questions were asked of the child, exactly what was asked of the child, because we don't want to use leading questions in getting answers from a child. We want to have open-ended questions where the child is actually leading the dialogue. Once we talk to that individual and any other person the child might have spoken to, oftentimes we find out that once a child does make an outcry, they'll tell a teacher, and maybe even the vice principal or principal or a counselor, that type of thing. We want to have all the information, all the pieces, before we even determine whether we need to speak to that child. If we have sufficient information, we will make then a referral to the Child Advocacy Center. We want to minimize the number of contacts a child has to make that repeated disclosure. We have found oftentimes that a child makes repeated disclosures over and over and over again. They get tired of it. They don't want to talk about it anymore. And it starts to affect their ability to recall what's happened to them. We want to minimize the number of times the child has to talk. We work with DHS to develop a safety plan to make sure that child is going to be safe once it leaves the school. And if it's not something involving the family, we want to make sure we're working with the school to make sure that child is safe as well. Unfortunately, I've grown to know Mr. Naso and Ms. Leith rather significantly in my years as a law enforcement officer. And the best thing I can tell you about working with the school is open lines of communication. We speak about all matters involving a child about that case. I'm trained in criminal statutes. I know how to conduct a criminal investigation. I know how to conduct a safety assessment. DHS knows how to conduct safety assessments. We work together with DHS to make sure a child is safe before we let it go back out in the big world, so to speak. We're trained on the Oregon interview guidelines and how to interview a child. We will receive reports from educators. Educators are just that, They are the safe keepers of our children, but they also that, just educators to our children. And they refer to us to make those important decisions about whether a child's going to be significantly safe or not. We work very closely with our community partners. And you talk about communication between the school district and DHS. Well, in a recent case involving North Clackamas Schools and myself, we worked very closely keeping a line of communication going back and forth, letting them know what was happening with the case, what the status of the case was, and they were letting me know what the status of their internal investigation was in this proceeding. Probably the best information I can provide is the establishment of open communication between schools, law enforcement, and DHS, and the fact that school district employees need to be regularly trained, repeatedly trained on mandatory reporting laws. Like my community partners have said, you know, it's ingrained them to them. At least I know it is in North Clackamas, but there's many other school districts that I work with. We have issues at times. And we go into the schools from the multidisciplinary aspect and provide them that education of mandatory reporting. I am open to any questions you all might have.
Mr. Green, I'm going to start with the last comment that you made because that one's really critical to me. That bill is not in front of this committee, but it's in Bill 372 that talks about mandatory reporters, increases penalties, takes away a license or suspends a license of someone who fails to report. And that in that bill, I think I'm going to have an amendment drafted, or I can do it here, that addresses this issue about training. There's no requirement in the statute that mandatory reporters have to get training in how to be a mandatory reporter. I believe if you are an attorney in Oregon, you have to take that as part of your continuing legal education credits. But teachers are not required under the statute to take courses or to take training. Legislators who are under the statute are not required to take training. I mean, we're mandatory reporters, and I bet you none of us have had any kind of training. Perhaps Senator Morissette has when he was a teacher, and perhaps Senator Starr when he was a teacher, but I've never had any training in how to report. So let me ask you that. Do you feel that that is a huge gap in the law as it exists?
Madam Chair, I know that school teachers, when they go through their basic education courses, receive training on mandatory reporting. But it's also my understanding that there's not a requirement after they receive their certification for that continued training of mandatory reporting. It is a gap in some aspects. I have friends who are dentists, physicians, chiropractors, and they're always asking me, how can we get better training for mandatory reporting once we're done with our initial certification? The Clackamas County MDT, I know, works very hard at training mandatory reporters. And I know the state of Oregon Department of Human Services, with money from the Children's Justice Act Task Force, developed a videotape of basic mandatory reporting. It's about a 22-minute videotape that goes along with the publication that was over on the table about mandatory reporting from the Department of Human Services. It is a gap. And as my brother, Mr. Green, spoke, it is only a violation, nothing more than a simple fine. I've encountered circumstances where I've submitted a case to the district attorney's office regarding failure to report as a mandatory reporter. It is a violation. But if it is a certification process, I will also submit a report to that certification board for that individual. However, it's my opinion that there needs to be some more bite in the law regarding mandatory reporting. And as Mr. Naso and Ms. Leeds said, you know, they tell their staff members not to wait till 2:30 in the afternoon about that bruise in the child's face. We've dealt with school districts in the past. They wait till the end of the year from something that they get told at the start of the school year.
Let me ask you this, because you just brought it up. Have you ever reported someone for failure to report, and has that case been prosecuted?
Yes.
Well, that was a two-part question, so yes to both parts?
Madam Chair, yes to both parts. But the prosecution very simplistic. It's preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt, it's a violation, much like a traffic ticket or possession of less than an ounce of marijuana.
That's my concern about that, too, Mr. Green. That's why I drafted the bill. And there's no threat of suspension of a license either, is there?
Madam Chair, no, there's not. Only if the investigator decides to turn that information over to a certification board.
Oh, I see. That part is also discretionary on your part as well.
Madam Chair, yes, it is, but I can assure you I'm not very discretionary about that.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Does the committee have any questions? All right. Well, I appreciate that answer. And one of the...
Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
But what Detective Green, what I interpreted his largest concern to be was a consistency in reporting of abuses that we know in North Clackamas. We have been trained. This is a step-by-step protocol, and even someone who hasn't been trained can use this protocol. And I would agree there needs to be more meat to every mandatory must do it and must know how to do it in a timely manner. That's very different than what Mitchell was talking about in the Senate bill, that went a step farther to having the school districts actually be the investigators. And I certainly do not feel qualified to conduct an investigation of child abuse.
We will actually, we'll open a public hearing on those issues in a bit, and then I'd like to hear your comments about that. Right now, I just want the committee to get an overview about what happens when someone suspects child abuse, and so if you could hang out, we'll have you back up.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to remind everyone that certainly in reading some of the language of pieces, there seems to be a real emphasis here on how we deal with mandatory reporters. That is a significantly small portion of the reports that get made, as Ms. Lee pointed out. Her 31 complaints are filed, with the exception of one in her particular school this year, are pieces that are coming from other parts of the community. I just want to remember that in shaping law.
Do you sense any gaps in the law in the way that you are administering your policies now?
I do not. Quite frankly, when I was asked to come here this evening or this afternoon and was reading through these, I think my biggest concern was the degree to which we, at least in our school district, would be replicating what we thought was already in place. Now, there are some pieces that I would say are positive, closing of the circle, that information. And certainly just a reminder to all of us that perhaps there is some merit in making sure that these pieces are in policy. But there are certainly some pieces, and maybe I'll be able to talk about that later in the, the meetings, about some of the language here as to whether it's really replication of what most people in the education community already expect is the law.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much,
all of you.
We're going to hear next from Catherine Novy from the Salem-Keizer School District. Okay. And Ms. Novy's testimony, written testimony, is here at the dais, colleagues. Hi, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Catherine Novy. I'm the Director of Employee Relations at Salem-Keizer School District. And I'd like to thank the committee for the invitation to come and speak before you today about the policies and procedures that are used in our district regarding mandatory child abuse reporting. I'd like to confirm briefly that we have adopted the policy, very similar, if not exactly the same, as the one that was talked about by Jim Green, and also the administrative rules were adopted. These are the, you can just follow through the pages with me of what I've submitted, detailing exactly what policies and procedures are.
And Ms. Novy, when did your district adopt these policies? Have they been in place for a while?
They've been in place for many years. Okay. I do not know the exact year that they were adopted.
The administrator, Marjorie Taylor, shows me that there's a 6/99 in the lower left-hand corner.
Right. That would be the most recent update of that particular policy.
Okay.
That they were in force, is my understanding, quite a while earlier. Then included then also we have a harassment, intimidation, bullying, and menacing policy, both for students and staff. I include that because we don't limit the child abuse reporting to simply child abuse, but it's also carries over into acts of harassment towards students. So there's a crossover there. And we have policies there, our sexual harassment policy, and then also included are the rules for that, and the harassment, bullying, and menacing policy regarding staff, and the employee training generally, which includes training annually in the areas of discrimination, harassment, prejudice, and racism. That includes mandatory child abuse reporting, which perhaps you'd like to spend some more time on that. Underneath this next page is the agenda for our fall leadership team training. And We train every year, mandatory training for all staff. It starts with the leadership team, who are the building administrators and all of the other administrative team members. And they receive training. I conducted this training in cooperation with Sergeant Mark Chase from the Salem Police Department. Training covers both sexual harassment and child abuse mandatory reporting. Sergeant Chase is very much like Deputy Green. He's got extensive certifications and training and does a wonderful job of getting the information out to our administrators on what they should do and how they can process any complaints or concerns that are raised. He covers all the different types of child abuse, and so that they're clear that it's a whole broad spectrum. As part of that training, we use the next two sheets, mandatory reporting of child abuse and child abuse reporting obligations. And this is We go through these bullet points with everyone. This is a packet of materials that they take back with them to their schools. These are training tools that they can use when they train their own staff. The training is completed and signed off by every building administrator and other administrator in the district every fall. There's also, there are other mandatory trainings such as safety training, and that's signed off in the same way, but this is what we're focusing on right now. One of the key things that I think we do is that, and this was also shared by other individuals giving testimony, the duty to report remains with the individual employee. The administrator is always there to help them. The employee can come to the administrator and say, I've never done this before, I'm concerned, I'm confused, I'm scared. And the administrator will stay with them during the phone call. We're very fortunate to have school resource officers assigned either directly to schools or having responsibility for the schools. So they are available to us throughout the school day. If we have a situation where we think that an event has occurred or where one is reported to us, our reporting is as easy as walking over to the office of the school resource officer and saying, we need your assistance. And again, we allow them to conduct the investigation because they are trained in the best way to ask the questions so that the child does not have to repeat the situation multiple times. What we've been told by our officers and by other specialists is the more often a child has to report, the more difficult it becomes for them to tell the story, either because they feel that they've told and so now they can forget about it, or because they just become, it's more difficult for them to remember what happened. So we try to get the officer, either our SRO, or if for some reason they're not available, we'll call to the regular police department, get them interviewed as quickly as possible. We will isolate the, if it's not an individual in the school, then the officers in charge will take care of the investigation outside of the school. If the allegation is directed towards a member of the staff, that staff person will be isolated in a conference room until they can be interviewed by the SRO. We may also ask them to give a written rendition of what they think occurred. The same is true for any witnesses. So
let me stop you for a moment.
Yeah.
So I want to be very clear about this. There's been concern, not just expressed here today, but to me prior to coming to this hearing, that people are concerned that this one of the bills that is up for hearing would require the school to open an investigation. It sounds to me like you do that with your school resource officer.
The school resource officers are part of the Salem Police. They're simply assigned to us through, and I'm afraid I don't know the details of the agreement or the contract, but they are Salem police officers and have all those rules and regulations and all of that specialized training. So we are actually, although we start the investigation, I guess I would think of us as gatekeepers. We ask for the help from the professionals who really have this very specialized training.
Okay.
The last two pages of the packet are also a training tool that we use. This would be some procedures or protocols for mandatory child abuse reporting. And as you can see, it walks an individual. These are written with the focus of a building administrator, or if he wanted, or he or she wanted to share this with a an employee, how they should make the report. When we package this for the training, it is on the back side of it is the mandatory reporting form. So every employee is given a sample of the mandatory reporting form, and we walk through on the back or the front, depending on how you look at it, what the procedures are. This mandatory reporting form includes the current fax numbers for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Salem and Kaiser Police Departments, and we also let the staff know that they can report to DHS. DHS has the component of offering confidential reporting that is not available when you report to the police. So we want our employees to know that if they have a concern, they can report to DHS. But we encourage them to fill out this form so that they can confirm, if it needs to be later on, that they were that they did report, that they were mandatory reporters and did report. So this is a tool that we use with all of our employees when they get this training. We also use...
Ms. Novy, when is that training? Is that training every year or just...
Every year in the fall.
Okay.
Employees who are hired after the fall training are trained by their building administrator when they begin their service. Substitutes are trained in a central office before they accept substitute positions. This includes all of our classified staff, custodians, office staff, anyone who works for us goes through this, the mandatory trainings that we offer.
Okay.
And we use a very excellent booklet. This is actually just a photocopy of the cover and a couple of pages on the inside. And I was talking with Una Swanson from DHS, and they have a wonderful new version of this, which we'll be ordering and using for training. I was just using this as an example of the booklet that we use for training. This is an excellent product. If you want to call it a product, they put out a great pamphlet that describes specifically for any individual coming from any kind of background who may not understand clearly what all of this can include, and outlines the statute specifically. And that's a document that is available in our buildings for people to review. And we often distribute it or a smaller version of the pamphlet to them. Let's see. I think that I think that's about it, unless you have some questions for me, Madam Chairman.
I do, Ms. Novy. As I promised, I'm not going to be talking about a specific case in your district, but let me ask you this. What are you going to be doing differently? I understood Ms. Baker was going to be doing something different in the district now, some different kind of training and some other way to sort of beef up your reporting.
One thing that is underway, my understanding of this, and I don't have all the details, is a committee that is going to be forming to look at doing training not only with our staff, but also offering training opportunities for parents and other community members, because this is an issue that needs to be responded to by the entire community, by anyone who sees it, and to provide them the information, and if they want to come through us with this information, the promise to pass it along and to oversee that. So this committee is going to get together and design and plan training that can be implemented, is my understanding. I don't have all the details because it's still in the planning stages.
Mm-hmm. So would it be similar to the training you give your staff currently every fall? You would make that training available to the public?
I think it would, and I think where we might expand on it is we talk about the issues as they might see them at a school. What would you see at school? What would happen? What might you observe about a child? And I think that what we would do is expand it into what would you look for in the community? What would you see perhaps if you were at a Little League game or out having a picnic with your family and you see something going on? What would that mean? What would bad behavior? What would this look like? What should you expect to see? And then what can you do with that information and provide that training to people?
Okay. Could you explain how you talk to the children in your schools? Is there any kind of training or program available to the kids to let kids know that their body is their own, that if they feel they are being abused in some way, excuse me, they need to bring it to the attention of their teacher or an administrator or a counselor?
I'm afraid that I didn't come prepared to talk about that aspect of child. I was focused mostly on mandatory child abuse reporting. I know that that conversation like that, that they have counselors in the schools and information of that nature is provided. There's the safe schools or safe. There's some programs that are offered by the police departments. I'm just not certain I didn't get any information gathered up for that. I'd be happy to find out what that is and send a supplemental report to your committee.
Yes, I would appreciate that. I'd like to know what your district does to, other than, because I did look in the statutes and you're required to post a sign in mm-hmm. schools that about harassment. And you're required to do that, but you're not required to do anything else. And so I'm just kind of curious what you do, and a lot of the schools don't even have school counselors anymore. And if they do have school counselors, a lot of them are now academic counselors rather than mental health counselors or someone you can go to and talk to behind a closed door about a problem that you have. Some of the schools, like the high schools that have school-based health centers, they have more resources available for young people. But I'm particularly interested in what you do in the elementary and middle schools.
Yes, and I'm sorry I wasn't prepared for that. I'm sure that there's training going on. I've heard anecdotally just people talking about, they were talking to a child who, you know, was talking about something they had heard. I just don't want to be more specific until I have information, but I'd be happy to submit a supplemental report to you with the details of that.
I'd appreciate that.
Great.
So the committee, have any questions? Ms. Lee, could you come up here for a second, please? And I'm going to ask you that question. I don't know if your school has any training for children, because you are an elementary school principal. Do you have any kind of training?
Yes, in North Clackamas.
You'll have to state your
name. My name is Sally Leith. I'm principal of Oak Grove Elementary School, Madam Chair. In North Clackamas, we have counselors who have received training together in sessions that have been sponsored by the district, and they go class to class and do child abuse prevention curricula.
Ah.
And they'll talk not only about danger stranger, but you know, what is safe, what doesn't feel good, what all of the things that would be red flags for our children. They provide for opportunities to children to disclose to them in privacy at another time. They provide for little slips of paper for the children to write down things that may or may not have a concern to them. They follow up on those. We also take advantage of a program in the metro area called Kids on the Block, which is a puppet program, and one of the ones that is most used is a good touch, bad touch puppet program aimed primarily at first, second, and third graders that has some pretty powerful messages, and the children respond very well to that. We also frequently throughout the course of a school year, we talk to children about, if something is bothering you, find a safe adult to talk about, to talk to that person about it.
How often do you do the training with the kids at the beginning of each school year, going into each classroom?
Typically, it's not right at the beginning of the year, because you want some time for the children, especially those that are new to the school, to feel comfortable with the mm-hmm. personnel. Okay. So first semester, typically, that happens.
So maybe like in
before
late.
We try to get it done before Christmas. We try to get it done especially before holidays, mm-hmm. because holidays tend to be the toughest times on children who are struggling with things in their personal life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How long have you folks been doing this kind of training?
Oh, I've been a principal since 91. We haven't always had counselors in our buildings. And once we started getting counselors in our buildings, mm-hmm. acting in a counseling capacity, that kind of training began. Prior to that, quite honestly, it was hit or miss, and it was mm-hmm. More school by school dependent. But it's part of what our counselors do, and they work very closely yeah. together to make that happen.
That's a really good statement about why it's so important to have counselors in our schools.
I couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Leap, for coming up and clarifying that. Next, we have Una Swanson with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
Okay, and then, colleagues, you have here at your station some information that I think Ms. Swanson's going to testify about.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And thank you for this invitation to be here today. I believe I was invited to talk about what happens when a child abuse report was received. Mm-hmm. And I do want to direct you to a couple of the materials that I brought. One of them's already been mentioned, and this is what can you do about child abuse? And this is a resource that's not only used by the Department of Human Services, but by other entities. I think it's used many times by multidisciplinary teams in working with community partners. But for the purpose of my discussion, I think I'll direct you to page 14 of that document, just to have there as a reference. I also wanted to point out just a very broad-based graph that I developed that says that it's a child welfare casework flowchart for CPS assessment. And then the second page of that are some bullets that are just information that I may reference as I talk about the Child Protective Service, what Child Protective Services does when a Child Protective Service report is received. And a number of things have already been mentioned, so I won't spend too much time going over that, but we have staff that are called screeners. And Child Protective Service screeners are the people, the staff people identified in our child welfare offices on our child abuse hotline to receive reports of child abuse. The position of a screener determines whether the information that they're hearing from the reporter, whether that information in fact is about child abuse or neglect, or whether in fact they might need to call another agency. That's one level of screening, that maybe they needed to be calling legal aid, or maybe they needed to be calling the health department or another entity. Then the next level of screening is if the caller is concerned about child abuse or neglect, the screener is determining whether or not there is in fact reason to believe that there's a safety threat for that child. So they'll begin a process, a guided process in fact, of going through a number of questions to determine from the reporter whether or not there actually is a safety threat for that child and has abuse or neglect occurred. And as the screener moves through that process, one of the things they're looking at is to determine, is this something that needs an immediate response? The Department of Human Services is not in a position to do what's called a 911 response, certainly. That's a law enforcement piece. But we respond immediately if we receive calls such as from a school that there's a child at school with an injury, or if there's a report that there's an infant at the hospital that has suspicious injuries that appear to be abuse. We may get a call that there are toddlers in a home where the police have just found a methamphetamine labs. Those would be examples of things that we're immediately responding, and most often in all of those situations working with law enforcement, as Officer Green described so well. There are situations that may not require an immediate response, and it could be that we have a child that's disclosed abuse about a person that lived in their household. That person doesn't live with them anymore, and we may develop a plan with law enforcement to interview that child in a planful way, or have an appointment scheduled for that child at an assessment center. So that might be an example of something where we would have up to 5 days to get out and make that face-to-face contact. So one of the questions that I heard earlier, the comment that I heard earlier, is did you hear back from the Department of Human Services when you made a call to us? And we do require in our policy that the worker get back to the reporter. One of the things that happens if we respond to a school and we're actually working with the child and we're there in the school, we use that as our information to that reporter that we have assigned it. As far as giving additional information such as was this incident founded, what was the context of the information that we learned in that assessment, we wouldn't be able to share that with the caller due to confidentiality of the family. But we can tell them if it's been assigned for a face-to-face contact, if there's a worker that they can contact, if they have additional information that they'd like to share. We work with law enforcement to develop a safety plan. If we do identify that we have a child that's not safe, that there are threats to the child's safety in the home, we may be working with them to develop a plan to see that maybe the alleged perpetrator would leave the home so the child can stay home with a protective parent. In other situations, we develop a plan for the child to go into a relative's home or into foster care if they can't be safe in their home. And from there, for the Department of Human Services, we move on to develop plans that involve court involvement. If we have an issue of abuse where we filed a petition in juvenile court, there are times that we continue to work with families on a voluntary basis and provide services to them. There are times when children continue to be there in their home while we have court services open, and sometimes they're in foster care. And we may move completely through our system to a point where the child can be returned home, or there are situations where we develop an alternate permanent plan for that child. So that's kind of a broad overview, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, Ms. Swanson, I was reviewing a story. I've collected a number of these and put them in my file, and your name actually comes up in this one pretty frequently. The story is Failings Found in Foster Child's Case. Investigators identify problems with caseworkers' training and record-keeping regarding 6-year-old Jordan Knapp. That was February 19th of this year, just last week, I think. And there was discussion about some failings within the Department of Human Services on this case and others. So, and you are quoted in here that you would like to work to educate mandatory reporters about their responsibilities. So could mm-hmm. you speak to that, please?
I certainly will, and I'll speak to that in the context of that report, but also more broadly. The Department of Human Services, both at the local child welfare office and in the state office, we develop materials. We have a video. Very often, the local child welfare staff are involved with their multidisciplinary team in doing community mandatory reporter trainings. They will essentially do a mandatory reporter training for anyone who asks. They'll do that for churches or other community partners. And on the state level, we do regular mandatory reporter trainings for all state staff. We do that through the DHS building down the street. And some of the things that we noticed as we looked at this case and as we look at our practice across the state is that we have some of the same concerns that other folks do, that we need to find better ways to assure that everyone that needs training gets that training. We're not the only people who do mandatory reporter training. Certainly attorneys have folks that do that within their group. Law enforcement does training. The medical community will sometimes invite us in to do training for them, or they may do their own training. But as far as for our part, we want to begin to track the number of mandatory reporter trainings that are done by our staff across the state, and we want to keep that information on file and give that to the local SDA managers, so that in doing that we can begin to identify groups or parts of the community that we could focus on if they're not coming forward to request training, or we can begin to identify what's an area that we can begin to share more information.
So let me ask you, would DHS be interested in training the Legislative Assembly?
We would be happy to do that. That's a large group, but we'd be happy to help with that,
well,
certainly.
It is, Ms. Swanson, but you know, every year we get this harassment training that all of us just moan and groan about taking because we get it every year. But we've never had training in child abuse reporting, and we're mandatory reporters, so it just seems to me that would be an easy thing to do in one of our assembly sessions for each, and we can do a joint session. I'll bring that up with leadership. But the other issue in this particular article about this case is that that you're working with a team of national experts doing a separate independent review of the child welfare system to look at what information should be included in case records. That's important in this situation, too, that we're talking about today, about reporting of sex abuse and child abuse in schools. And that's kind of what I'm getting at in some of my legislation here is, too, how do we circle back? How do we know that you guys haven't dropped the ball? I mean, let's be honest here. You're overworked, underpaid, understaffed. But how do we know, as a reporter, that you haven't dropped the ball, that you actually have implemented an investigation, you have turned it over to law enforcement, and how do we know what it is that you have turned over to law enforcement? Mm-hmm. So could you respond to that?
Certainly. The Child Protective Services work that we do is guided both by statute and then by our Oregon administrative rules. And as I mentioned earlier, one of those rules does require that the CPS assessment worker, the CPS worker, does report back to the person who called them if they can locate them. We do receive some calls that are anonymous, but they do have a requirement to report back to that person, let them know the call was received, and let them know the action that was taken. Again, as I said earlier, we would be sharing information such as this has been, your call was received, it's been assigned, and we've made contact with that family, and we're looking into that situation. It's frustrating for the mandatory reporter sometimes to not then be told additional information about it, especially not all of our calls come from mandatory reporters, but that's particularly frustrating for extended family members that we might not be able to share specific information about, but we do try to invite extended family into family meetings so they have more information. But that is a requirement in our rules, so what I'm hearing today is it sounds like we need to reinforce that and provide more oversight in that particular area, both from the state level and at the supervisory level. It's something that the worker has to check off on their CPS assessments as they're completed.
Okay, and then my other question is, when someone makes a report with your agency, do you ask them if they're a mandatory reporter? Do you ask them for their name? And I believe a mandatory reporter would have to use their name.
Yes.
So that's really a three-part question.
Okay.
So take it in whatever order you like.
Okay, Chair Walker, I think that what I heard is when a mandatory reporter calls us, do we take their name and do we record that information? And yes, we do. The information is recorded, and we have a document that we work from when we're doing a child abuse investigation that we call it's a 307. It's a CPS assessment document. And there's a way within that document that we can keep that reporter information confidential, but it is recorded within our system. But if we were to print that to be shared with law enforcement or other parties, we can keep the reporter information confidential.
Okay. All right, does the committee have any questions? All right. Ms. Novi, do you want to come up? Go ahead and stay there, Ms. Swanson. Ms. Novi wants to respond to something. You need to sit and state your name in the microphone. I'm sorry. These are recorded in perpetuity, so 50 to 100 years from now, people will be able to hear you speak today.
Well, my name is Catherine Novi with the Salem-Keizer School District. During the time that I wasn't here speaking to you, I was able to do some research via the phone regarding what child abuse training we have, or training for the protection of children at our schools. At the elementary level, every fall, they offer both the Stranger Danger courses and the Good Touch, Bad Touch courses, and often use the Kids on the Block program, as Principal Wheat was saying they do in Oak Grove. We do have counselors in all of our schools. Some of them are split between two small schools, but that means that the children get services at least a few times a week. at the younger ages, these are specifically, there's very little academic counseling that goes on at that point, so they are talking with the children about their emotional and home lives, etc. They also hold regular classroom sessions on different topics a couple of times a month, and at that point let the children know that they can come and talk to them if they have an issue on that particular topic that they're speaking of. They also address safe touch in all of the health classes from elementary through high school. And that the health class is the primary place where they talk about their self-protection in middle and high school. They also have counselors, both academic and non-academic, in middle and high school, and they do classroom presentations. We also have a position called a CSOC, which is a community education, community outreach coordinator. And they work with the families on a closer level and would do a variety of things, including making phone calls to see if children, why children are absent or what the home situation is. Often they make immunization calls under the direction of the school nurses who we don't have at every school, but we use a CSOC or a health aide to assist with that. So those are some of the resources that we offer the children for their education about how they can be safe and how they can come and report to us.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from the committee in response? I appreciate you making that phone call, Ms. Novi.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to close the informational hearing. And do you want to take these one at a time?
Or? Yeah.
Okay. Let's open a public hearing on, and a work session. Well, we'll open a public hearing, on Senate Bill 749. And we have Julie McFarland with the Juvenile Rights Project. And you want to come on up?
Good afternoon, Senator Walker and members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and we are a law firm that represents children throughout the state of Oregon and also in juvenile court in Multnomah County. And I have submitted a letter to you that's fairly extensive, and I'm not going to repeat the information that's in there, but I want to just hit a few high points. We support this legislation because we are concerned about the amount of underreporting of abuse that occurs in this state, as in every other state, and we believe that this bill will help to improve that situation. Between 24% and 61% of abuse and neglect cases do not get reported to the Child Protective Services system, and this is based on the national incidence studies that have been done, which have shown that children of a younger age, approximately 24% of those cases do not get reported, and as children get older and into adolescence, a higher percentage of those cases do not get reported to CPS. So there are a lot of cases that are not getting reported, and as Detective Green testified earlier, school employees are one of the biggest groups of mandatory reporters who have a great deal of direct contact with children and are in a position to become aware of situations where children are being abused and neglected and to make those reports. The costs of undetected abuse are very high, and I have cited a number of sources and information in my letter. There are, of course, fatalities, serious physical injuries, sex abuse, lifelong psychiatric and emotional effects, and very poor outcomes for children who have histories of abuse and neglect, and these, of course, all lead to high costs for government because these children who have these outcomes and injuries end up being cared for by the state or having to receive services from the state and become less than fully productive citizens. So we have a helpline at the Juvenile Rights Project, and we get about 700 calls a year to that helpline. Many of them are from children and adults calling on behalf of children about abuse situations. We make 6 to 10 abuse reports a month, and we have had a number of calls that have come from school employees, and we have found that it is very common, despite the testimony about the excellent training programs that exist in some counties, that it is still very common to our experience to have school employees who do not understand the reporting requirements. The most common error that is made is that many school employees believe that they have fulfilled their obligation if they have reported their observations to their principal or the supervising person in their school. And we have talked to many teachers who have not directly reported because they gave the information to the principal and assumed that they had then fulfilled their obligation. So attorneys have had, as has been noted, the requirement to have training on child abuse reporting, and of course I've had that training twice. It's required every 3 years for attorneys. And what I've observed in participating in that training is that even among attorneys who one would hope would have kind of a leg up on reading and interpreting the statute, that there are many questions and there's much confusion about what is really required in terms of being a mandatory reporter. So this is a complex area, and it is an area in which it is very appropriate, I believe, for the legislature to require training, and not only for teachers, but for all mandatory reporters, so that they have the information to fulfill their statutory duties. And certainly, in terms of discussing the possibility of increasing penalties, which I also support and think is appropriate, it is only fair that we require that that training occur before we implement increased penalties. We are suggesting one small amendment, and that's because of the problem that we have noted with teachers believing that if they have talked to their principal, they have fulfilled their reporting obligation. And that's on page 4 of my testimony. In section 4, page 2 of the bill, line 18, we would recommend that you add the language to the existing language there, and the obligations of school employees under the reporting of child abuse law. And that's to make it clear that the training they receive is not just to identify abuse or prevention and investigation of child abuse, but also that they are specifically trained on the mandatory child abuse reporting law, and so that it can be clear that their obligations under the reporting law take precedence over any requirements that the district may have about reporting internally within the school.
That's a very good suggestion, Ms. McFarlane, so thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Okay. And I would just add one more comment, if I could, that I agree that the problem of the feedback loop not being closed is a significant problem. We do not get feedback when we make mandatory child abuse reports, which we do with some regularity. And so I think that is an issue that needs to be addressed by the agency or in legislation.
Thank you. And Senator Cruz has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's something that's I've always been curious about. And how do you come up with a percentage of what's not reported? You know, I mean, there's got to be some fairly broad assumptions, Steve. I mean, how do you do that?
Senator Walker, Senator Cruz, I think it's interesting, and I discuss in my footnote about the National Incident Study and how they did that. But basically, they selected a period of time. They came up with definitions of what would constitute abuse or neglect. And then they surveyed professionals who dealt with children. I understand that that included school personnel, psychologists, and people like that, and got feedback on the numbers of cases that that they had identified. So it's a pretty clear indicator that there's under-reporting of abuse.
Madam Chair, I'd also say that that's a pretty suspect number then. I still, in my mind, and you can create models and do all this stuff, but to put a number on something that you don't know is questionable.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's not there, but to put a specific 25%, maybe it's 40, maybe it's 10. You know, and a national model doesn't necessarily interpret down to each individual case, so just an observation.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. McFarlane. I appreciate your testimony. I think Ms. Swanson, are you still here? Can you come on up and talk about this? And then I'm going to hear from Mr. Naso, and I'd like to also hear from Mr. Jeff Green. He didn't sign up, but I want to hear from him. Okay, so we're on Senate Bill 749.
Right. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Una Swanson. I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in regard to Senate Bill 749, and I'd like the committee to know that the Department of Human Services supports what we believe to be the intent of the bill, but are here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 749 as it is written. The department supports educational entities adopting policies on prevention, identification, and reporting of child abuse by district employees because that is our common goal to keep children safe. There are areas of the written Senate bill that we have some concerns about. Would you like me to go ahead?
Please,
okay.
Go through those because they're very similar to what I've heard before. So it's
okay. Right.
Really, let's just lay it out there.
Okay, Chair Walker. The first area of concern is similar to what you've heard from other people testifying today. It is of concern that the bill appears to require school district employees to investigate child abuse, and that is by statute that authority and responsibility is given to the Department of Human Services and to law enforcement. Again, the bill requires that district employees are trained again in the investigation. Very similarly, that's an authority that the Department of Human Services and law enforcement have. The third concern we have, again, is very similar to what you've heard. We would be concerned that there would be confusion about the responsibility of the mandatory reporter. The most important thing about the report is that it's timely and that it gets to the Department of Human Services or law enforcement. And a secondary concern or a secondary issue would be assuring that it went through a district employee. The fourth concern that we have is that the term other persons is not defined as used in Section 2, Line 10. Without a definition of other persons, it would seem to include all people. The Department of Human Services is supportive, again, of the intent, and we would be more than happy to work with our legislative counsel on any suggestions that we might have, and very much support the idea of additional training and requirements around mandatory reporting.
All right. Does anyone have any questions? I appreciate those comments because the concern I've been hearing expressed is this part about the investigation and who's doing it. So that's why I want to hear from Mr. Jeff Green again, because I don't think they want people mucking up their investigation. And but I need to get some more information about that. So thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
And Mr. Green, since I've been talking about you, why don't you and Mr. Naso come up together, and we can talk about this investigative part. And Ms. Leet, too.
Madam Chair, committee members, Detective Jeff Green, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. In my brief review of Senate Bill 749, my biggest question is, of course, the definition of investigation. As Ms. Una Swanson said, by statute, investigation is the authority of law enforcement and DHS when it comes to issues of child abuse. School employees are not trained to conduct investigations. They're not trained in the criminal statutes involving the many circumstances around issues of child abuse. They're actually a protector of children and an educator of children. Yes, they do receive lots of reports of child abuse, but it'd be my opinion that it could only muddy the waters up of a criminal investigation or even a DHS assessment of a suspected child abuse case. I can think of circumstances where a school employee or another employee who's a mandatory reporter is called in to testify in court regarding their part of the investigation and how their questioning of the child went. If that person isn't trained in how to forensically interview a child, it can actually destroy a criminal investigation. We're trained as law enforcement officers to conduct forensic investigations by guidelines set out in the Oregon Forensic Interview Guidelines. We're trained in that, as are DHS Child Protective Service workers, as are the forensic interviewers and the medical practitioners of child advocacy centers. If you're talking about an investigation, I would have to say no. If you're talking about a school district conducting an internal evaluation of suspected abuse by an employee, I know for a fact North Clackamas already does that, and we work very closely with North Clackamas when we're involved in the investigation of that matter. It's almost like Mr. Naso has my personal telephone numbers, along with Ms. Lee, when we're doing those types of investigations, as well as the Human Resource Director. Their policy is already in place in their district, and I know that for a fact. And they work very closely in dealing with law enforcement and conducting their part of their assessment, their evaluation of how or what their employees have done, and not cause the waters to muddy up on the criminal aspect of that investigation. And that's, like I said before, the greatest key to doing something like that is open communication between the two entities.
And Mr. Green, Detective Green, excuse me, your comment is really appropriate. An internal investigation is sort of what I was aiming at. Is it? I didn't want the district to just say they've turned it over to law enforcement and the teacher stays in the classroom, or whoever is doing the offensive behavior is still out there doing what they do. There needs to be some kind of internal investigation so that precautions are taken, so this person is placed on administrative leave pending completion of the investigation. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at, and that's not what we got, but does that make you happy?
Madam Chair, with that definition of that, it would make me very happy. However, perhaps a better wording of the term investigation like assessment, evaluation, something like that, better identifies what the process would be for a school district to do. When you're speaking of the word investigation, you're flashing back to the television programs of Law and Order and something like that. If you're talking about an assessment evaluation, you're talking about an internal process within the school district. The school district, I would assume, not knowing a lot about school matters in that regard, but I would assume would already have an established policy on how to do that.
Okay. Senator Cruz has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's almost like we're going at two different things here, because my sense is most reports of child abuse don't involve school personnel. And now we're morphing into the school personnel thing, and I would assume that, that there's a different set of criteria, a different way that school districts deal with personnel matters other than this. And so you probably have a, an entirely different protocol already set up for dealing with that. Would that be a good assumption?
Chair Walker, Ron Naso, Superintendent North Clackamas School District. The short answer to that is yes, if this involves an employee. And I appreciate, Senator Cruz, you're picking up the distinction here, because there's a bill before us that I think is, at times I get the sense, is trying to get at when a school employee is the person responsible for the abuse. But the bill is phrased in such a way that it covers all abuse. And as I indicated before, out of 31 cases that were reported, one of those had something to do with an employee. And if the law, if the bill remains as it is currently set, 5 and 6 says to me that the school is supposed to conduct an investigation, external or internal, on those other 30 cases. So what we've got, we're in a position where we're having to talk to the very parents whose children we're trying to serve, mm-hmm. and that's almost an impossibility, just from the emotional standpoint. So I would just indicate that I think 5 and 6 under Section 2 of this bill need to be mm-hmm. either eliminated or clarified as to what we're really talking about here. The school, as Detective Green has indicated, the school is neither prepared nor capable of conducting investigations of the nature that would be demanded in these cases.
I guess my sense is that most schools have protocols to deal with not just employees in this venue, but other venues that are outside of what's legal. And this clearly is outside of what's legal. And I would be interested, Madam Chair, in seeing some examples of those protocols to see if there are areas in there that we need to address.
Mm-hmm. I don't know where we are in the testimony.
I would just like I went off course. But
okay. I would just like to point out one other area of the present proposal of the bill. And that is Section 2, Number 4, on line 17. And it's just a clarification. Is the designation of a person within the district to receive reports in addition to the reporting to the supervisor or other person designated in line 15 and 16? In other words, do we have a two-tiered reporting piece? And if so, I just question the necessity of that in a, particularly in a large school district, and probably even more so in a small school district.
No, I don't think we're looking at two different people, but it
okay.
could be.
So four is it? Okay.
There must be a supervisor or other person designated by the policy under Section 3. Could make that more clear.
Yeah,
I wouldn't
that
want
would
it
to be helpful.
More. I mean, we barely have enough people to go around as
it is. Yeah, we know. The other thing, I would like to support the comment that was made, and I forget the section where it designates, district employees and other persons.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that phrase, other persons, needs to be better defined. You may well be talking about school volunteers, where we certainly would be equipped to write policy. But beyond that, there are a whole lot of folks for whom our policies have no status, just in terms of writing law.
Okay. Okay. Those are good comments. Ms. Leeds, did you have any comment?
I think they've addressed the concerns that I had with the division of the internal versus external. And I might also add that of the 31 reports and the one internal, I'm stretching my mind and I'm hard-pressed to come up with a second internal report in my 15 years as an elementary principal.
Well, would you say, I'm getting the sense that you have a tremendous symbiotic relationship with your police agencies in your community. You have a tremendous training program. Mm-hmm. Do you think all of those things combined have really helped you be more proactive as a district to prevent these kinds of things?
I would say absolutely. I would say also that school personnel recognize that they are held in a position of trust by our communities, and as such, we will do whatever we can to maintain that trust.
I would also comment that in this area, Chair Walker, all it takes is one incident, and it doesn't even have to be in your school district. In our particular case, we certainly are, you know, we're aware of the very tragic incident that came out of Oregon City. It causes all of us to go back, take a look at our policies, our procedures, all of those things. So that happens on a regular basis, and it certainly causes us to reacquaint ourselves with our relationships with DHS and the police department. So all of that happens, I think, is a matter of keeping children safe.
And I think that's our goal, everyone's goal here. I don't get the sense that's not the goal, and DHS certainly is being responsive to some of the concerns we have today. So. Okay, did you have anything else?
I have one more
yes.
comment.
Detective, please.
Under Section 4, Sub 1, regarding providing education on prevention, identification, and investigation of child abuse, I believe, again, using that term investigation might not be a well fit for that part of the section.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wish we could make all mandatory reporters have to have annual training on child abuse.
We're going to work on that.
I would love to help you out on that, Adam.
Well, thank you. I would ask you to inquire of Senator Burdick to get that bill. I think it's going to have a hearing. Let her know your interest in that bill, because that's in the Judiciary Committee. And then would you agree with the amendment that Ms. McFarlane recommended? I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but she recommended in that section that we add the words after child abuse and the obligations of school employees under the reporting of child abuse law, and then the citation.
Part of the training?
Yeah.
I think those are the two components
okay.
that are in
okay.
our training programs now.
So great. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 749? You're not signed up. Okay.
Yes. Before you close, I'm assuming we're not going to work session.
Oh, no. No. And this bill was the more complicated of the two that needed okay. some changes,
can
and I knew
can
that.
Can I just voice a couple
yes.
of concerns?
Yes, absolutely.
In Section 2, all district employees and students are subject to the policy. Would that require that the students all be trained? Because how could they be subject to the policies if they haven't been trained? So that's just a question there.
Okay, what line is that?
That's line 12, page 1.
Okay.
And then the other another issue, page 2, lines 20 through 25, is who the schools are going to offer this training to. If you're going to offer it to students and parents and legal guardians, that's a whole lot of folks, and that might require more resources than are available. Just, you know, maybe that would be more appropriate for DHS to do rather than the schools. just a thought.
My thought on that, Senator, was that, for instance, when my children were in high school, I went to the administration. We had two suicides within a year. And I went to the administration and asked them if I could put on a parent suicide, teen suicide awareness night. The administration said yes. I invited experts to come in. and we had an open night for parents to come in and get that training. That was 1995, I think. It was very early on. Now they have them, and lots of people attend. But that's sort of what I envision, that the training just be made available through the district, like a parent night.
I guess I'm just sensitive. We over the years require more and more things of teachers and school personnel, and I think we need to be sensitive that we don't dump too much in their lap. And I also, while this is important and it needs to be done, I don't want us to get so hypersensitive in this area that, I mean, I can remember many, many times when I would go to school and have bruises or scars or whatever. No abuse, all self-inflicted, falling out of trees or whatever. And I just want to make sure that we aren't going too far and creating a sense of paranoia that if I don't report everything, I mean, there has to be a balance here. And clearly the proper training helps achieve that balance.
That's right.
Personally, I think the penalties in place for a teacher, $1,000 is a lot of money. So I think it may be the penalties may be appropriate.
Actually, it's $650 at this point, I think.
Is it?
Yeah, it's very minimal.
I would say most teachers would say that $650 is not minimal.
Yeah.
But
I appreciate your comments, Senator Cruz, because my son was one of those who fell out of trees a lot. He had three broken arms, two at once, and he was always running into things and falling off of things. So I understand that, but I think that's the training piece, and that's why it's important that we have proper training. Okay, well, we'll have some more discussion about this. I think we've got some good places to go. I'm going to close. Did you have a comment, Senator Starr?
No.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 749, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 755, and I'm actually going to ask the committee administrator to do her job. I always forget to ask her to do that part. So take it away, Marjorie.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 755 directs school districts and education service districts and charter schools to disclose disciplinary records of employees who are convicted of certain crimes, and that's the bill as printed. However, attached to your staff measure summary, you have the -1 amendment that has been provided to the committee by Senator Walker, which basically it defines disciplinary records in school district in the public school context, and it also defines disciplinary records in private schools within a private school context. And by the way, when the districts and schools are providing the records to the public, information will be removed from those records that would disclose the identity of a child or a victim.
Thank you. Very good job. I should ask you to do that more often. Get me under the table. All right, colleagues, the amendments came from my discussions with Oregon Education Association and some other folks about how we needed to more clearly define what disciplinary records meant, what school district meant, and to make sure that we captured that by saying a school district as defined in ORS 332.002, and then list out the schools that we would want to make sure that we cover. And then the ACLU came to me with a comment or two this afternoon. And so we're going to hear from Andrea Meyer. First, I want to hear from Mr. Naso, since he's hung in there so diligently, and see what you have to say about this bill. Can you state your name again for the record, please?
Thank you once again, Ron Naso, Superintendent, North Clackamas School District. Certainly, I'm going to be anxious to hear testimony from others who are probably more skilled in the law than I am. Let me explain to you what my concerns were when I read this through. And I'm referencing lines 10 and 11 in the original bill, and I suspect in the new bill it is 20 and 21. And the concern is to any person upon request. Once again, that's a pretty broad group of people in terms of releasing records. And I would want to make sure that we understand that there could be in a discipline file information that has nothing to do with the issues that were constituted as the felony or crime listed, and to just open those records up to I guess a parent would qualify, community individual who is just interested in what goes on in schools. And so we have a little bit of concern about personnel law there. The second part is that there is a reference, as it was pointed out, that we wouldn't disclose the identity of a child or a crime victim. But there also could well be circumstances in an employee's discipline file that make reference to another employee in a less than, not in a criminal way, but certainly in a potentially embarrassing way. And we might be, you might be putting us into a situation where you think you're asking us to release information about employee X who has been found guilty of something. But in doing that, we're releasing information that relates to another employee and might well be violating their rights under both law and under just good common sense. So, again, not for or against, just pointing out that there are some potential problems in the wording as it's currently constructed.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Nuso. Anyone have any questions? Ms. Meyer, do you want to come up?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I really need to start out with an apology to the chair because this is something that I've only been looking at today, and even as the committee's been going on, I've been reading a manual that I grabbed that I rely on. It's the Attorney General's Public Records Manual Meeting. It's where I get my information. This is not all in my head. When I spoke to the senator earlier today, I indicated a few concerns we have with the language. And I failed to ask the sort of getting some information on the background of this bill. Because as I sit here today and look at the, in the public records, I mean, the principle is that public documents and public records include school districts. So I just want to kind of lay out the obvious. They're part of the public bodies. They're clearly included. And our policy in Oregon is that records are available to the public. And then there's a scheme set up that has exemptions, some that are a balancing test, and then others that no way you can ever get a hold of these documents, like personal telephone numbers and other things. And they're all delineated very carefully with case law and explanations around them in here. And it says that public records law is primarily a disclosure law rather than a confidentiality law. The exemptions in the two laws are limited in their nature and scope because the general policy of the law favors public access to government records. So the conditionally exempt section, the one where you can if the public interest outweighs, includes personnel discipline actions and materials and documents supporting that action. So currently, I'm concerned because currently the law does allow for access. It talks about the policy. The policy underlying this narrowly construed exemption is to protect the public employee from ridicule for having been disciplined, but does not shield the government from public efforts to obtain knowledge about its process. Consistent with this policy, there are situations when the public interest in disclosure outweighs the public interest in confidentiality despite the imposition of a disciplinary sanction on a person. For example, the public interest typically favors disclosure if the conduct potentially constitutes a criminal offense or if the records relate to an alleged misuse or theft of public property by public employees. It further states, other factors to consider in weighing the public interest in disclosure against the employee's interest in confidentiality include the employee's position, the basis for the disciplinary action, and the extent to which information has already been made public. So the degree that someone has, in fact, been convicted of a felony, including those listed, the whole section of those listed under OS 342-143 are reasons that they wouldn't get licensed to begin with, may already be part of the public discussion. And certainly, I think someone could easily make a good case, and they should get the records for the public interest if that person has been. And if the school is refusing, the body is refusing to provide those, the next recourse in a local entity is to go to the DA. If it's a state entity, it's the Attorney General, to have them get the documents, secure the documents, and release them. And Chair Walker, my apologies in not quite knowing the genesis of this, and if there was a particular problem that arose that documents were not provided, because we are, I'm concerned, and Kalina's, the ACLU is generally very concerned about tinkering too much with the public records, both because of the all of the implications around it. I'm happy to work with you and flush out if there's a problem here that's specific that hasn't been addressed and that someone's denying records, where it may very well be that that should never have happened.
There is a problem.
And
Ms. Meyer, and if we'd had more time to talk, you'd have probably been enlightened about that problem. The problem arises out of a case in this district, the school district, that I've agreed that we will just talk about peripherally today, where a teacher was convicted, and a certain newspaper actually had asked for the records and was denied those records. Now, the conviction had not taken place yet when the request was made, and the district attorney released some of the records, but not all of them. And it's my understanding that each district has their own set of rules about what is available with a personnel file. And that's why I worked with the Oregon Education Association about trying to get access to these records. I think these records are critically important for anyone in the community who sees that an administrator or a teacher or someone who is there teaching our children and who abuses our children. I think they need to know how it was that this happened in their school. They don't need the administration telling them, well, we'll look into it. They need to be able, if they want to access the records and get that information and ask their own questions independent of what the administration may tell them. So that's why we have this bill in front of us today. And I understand one of the objections that you raised today was that you didn't want this to include any felony, that you wanted the information that was accessible by the parties to be only related to the conviction, the felony conviction that the person is being.
Chair Walker, I'm happy.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, and I just, if a school districts may have their own rules about how to handle requests, but they better be complying with the Oregon law. And they don't have different laws or regulations to which they must follow. They must comply with the public records law, and if they aren't, then they need to be pursued, because it's not up to district to determine what it is and what isn't. Because even under this, the discipline records, it's a balancing test, and they are not uniformly unobtainable by the public. And then clearly here, it seems that there's no question in why the balancing test and the Attorney General's opinion and case law around it. There's a Portland Public School District case where the court poo-pooed that whole argument in terms of discipline of an employee, and they forced the school district to release the documents.
All right, Ms. Meyer, just a second. What I want you to do is provide the committee with the citation that you read. Actually, just photocopy that. Any case law that you can cite us to, because I took this concept into legislative council and I said, where's the gap? What can we fix? And this is the bill that I have to fix the gap.
Chair Walker, this would make a change. I mean, there is a balancing test right now.
Okay.
It's not simply up to the school district personnel to decide, I don't like this or I don't want to give this. There is principles behind it, and the court has said, and the Attorney General said, when there's criminal action and it's public knowledge and those sorts of things, that absolutely weighs to disclosing it. So there are not just guidelines, but there's sometimes case law that will influence. This, however, would never allow it would require it to be released. So it would remove any balancing test at a time where there might be information that potentially shouldn't be released, which gets to why we're always nervous about it. So it would make a difference in the law. It would change the law and remove sort of any discretion, not just the school district, but the attorney general or the district attorneys from assessing that. The concerns with the narrowing language is that, as you'll see in the bill, it refers to crimes listed in ORS 342143. Those are the laws, those list about 25 conviction crimes of which a teacher could not receive a license to teach, period, if they have a conviction. They are many of the sex crimes, many of the person crimes, also property crimes of arson, robbery, all the ones that doesn't make someone eligible, and that would be, we suggested that would be the type of discipline that would be relevant when you sweep in convicted of any felony. It could be someone being disciplined for unlawful labeling of sound recording or unlawful recording of a live performance, because there are a lot of crimes out there that are felonies, but they may not be, and they may be disciplined about it, and then the issue comes down to, with the balancing test, you can decide if that's something that should be released to the general public request, or whether that's something in the discretion of an employee engaged in conduct that they should be disciplined, but it shouldn't necessarily be disclosed to the public in full. And then, as I mentioned to you, I think it's in artful language, because I absolutely know what your intent here is, and we talked about this on line 10, the use of any employee language. So as it says, I mean, I understand we're trying, what the goal of this language is to get to the employee who was convicted and get their disciplinary records.
And Ms. Meyer, that's been fixed in the dash one amendment.
Oh, has that been fixed?
Yeah,
by any?
On line 21.
Okay.
It says the employee.
So those are two concerns. And again, I apologize. I'm doing speed reading, and I will get you all of this, because if the situation with the press unable to get someone who was convicted and it's been in the newspaper.
I don't believe the press made that request. I believe the request was made before the conviction.
Right. I know that in reading here, it does talk about if discipline is taking place, they tend to wait. Because the argument is if it's in the process, we need to determine if it's there's discipline that's occurred. And so once the disciplinary process is complete, then they should, that's when they engage in the balancing test.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay. If somebody's convicted of a felony, and I don't mind including all felonies, I don't think, even if it's pirating music, I don't want felons teaching my kids, period. But if a person's convicted of a felony, disclosure of the trial, all the findings are available through the judicial system, correct?
Well, not necessarily.
Well, I guess I'm wondering what additional information.
The disciplinary file, Senator Cruz, would not be, for instance, in this particular case, this gentleman copped a plea. So he pled, the district attorney offered a plea, and he took it, and there was no bench trial. He just appeared in court, a judge asked him if he was guilty, and he accepted the charge, and he got sentenced.
Right.
So his disciplinary files were never introduced as evidence in the record that I know of.
But he'll never teach again either.
No, but the point here is not necessarily to know about this individual, but to know how it got to this point. What happened? What fell apart in this school district that allowed this to continue for a period of time? That's what people in the district, that's what a parent wants to know. They want to ask those questions about what fell apart. How did this happen? Because the allegations are that this gentleman was engaged in this behavior for a long period of time and that several complaints were made. So give people the right to look in those files and determine for themselves and ask those questions.
And this is all post-conviction?
Yes, because you would not want to ask those things of someone while they're still being investigated, because we'd be involved in a witch hunt. And these people could be determined to be, the charges could be unfounded, the case dismissed,
And then you open up the disciplinary file to everyone, and I just think that's a total violation of their rights as an employee and a human being. So that's why this was very specific about upon conviction. And I would disagree with Mr. Naso. I think anyone who wants to look at that should be able to look at those files. It shouldn't be limited to law enforcement or a teacher or a parent. It should be anyone who wants to look at those files.
And Chair Walker, members of the committee, absolutely the public records doesn't distinguish between whether you're media or non-media or anyone
right.
else. They are our public records.
And colleagues, you'll be hearing about that tomorrow or sometime this week on another bill on the floor. Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Meyer. If you could get that to the committee. We are not certainly going to work session on this today, and I'd like to talk to committee members about it and keep moving forward. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 755. I want to thank the committee, and we'll see you on Wednesday. We are adjourned.